Hello and welcome to Optimist Economy. I'm Catherine.
I'm Robin.
On this show, we believe the U.S. economy can be better, and we talk about how to get there, one problem and solution at a time. We envision for this show to have three segments, and they're going to have really awesome, catchy, clever titles that are the epitome of being pithy and witty at the same time.
At some point in the future.
In the future. At the moment, this is called segment one.
Segment one.
The first segment. Robin, what did you look up this week? What did you read this week?
You know, I looked up a couple of words, but one was, now I don't know how to say it, autarky?
I think it's autarky.
And it's a great looking word, A-U-T-A-R-K-Y. But it can also be spelled with a C-H, which makes it look a little bit like autocratic. Autarky is a state of being economically independent or self-sufficient. Came up in the context of tariffs and trade policy. And I always find it interesting when new words just start popping up in especially journalistic outlets. It sort of signals that there's something going on. And that was the one I looked up this week.
Economists can use it synonymously with it's a country that doesn't trade.
Right.
So it's the positive version of that is that you're economically independent or self-sufficient, but we think of it as being on some level just this is a country that doesn't trade. And so their economy is, I think, in autarky. I think it's a noun. Yeah, it's not good. It's not like we're like, oh, man, no. Autarky, that's where we want to be. I think you could argue that there's only one true autarky in the world right now, and that's North Korea.
North Korea.
Yeah. It's not good. Self-sufficiency as an economy sounds great, but it typically means that you've closed yourself off to innovation, to communication, and to the world, and you're not as good as the world on your own, and you suffer for it. Economics is taught as if it's a science, but I have always thought of it as a language. Autarky is an example of a word that like only economists would really ever use, and it's part of our language and how we read the world.
Yeah, which is why it's interesting when it starts to pop up in journalistic discourse, right? I felt the same way with oligarchy. When you have to start learning new words as a newspaper reader, it's telling you something about what's happening in the culture. What did you look up this week?
Sometimes it's hard to find good news, and in my newsletter, Kedits, I've been trying to put kind of like see the points of light of what's going on in the current administration. So one thing that I got really deep in the weeds on this week was looking up the productivity of the 117th Congress, which is the Congress that started with Joe Biden's term in 2021. And what struck me as really remarkable is by the first week of March, not only had they impeached Trump for his involvement in January 6th, but they had passed the American Rescue Plan, and they had used their power and their resources to immediately address the economic needs of Americans, and they did it in a concerted and legal, above-the-board way. They helped childcare, they helped public education, they helped people with housing, they helped state and local governments, and they did it in about 5 weeks. I was looking this up because I'm trying to write something for my newsletter that puts this together with just how much weakness there is from all these executive orders and these constitutionally questionable, if outright constitutionally violating actions from Trump and Musk, that as much power as they're grabbing, it's because they don't have that much.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a sign of weakness. So I got really deep into the 117th Congress.
Nice.
And they passed so many laws. Apparently, every time you rename a post office, it's a law. So there's just
an individual post office?
Like an individual post office is named after somebody. It requires Congress to vote on it. And so I was like, okay, let's pass the American Rescue Plan. We're going to include the child tax credit to have child poverty and almost eradicate it in the United States. And then it's like post office, post office, post office, post office. It's not good for my mental health to discuss Congress any further than we just have.
Exactly. This is a good stopping point on that.
Ready for our natural transition to segment two?
It's supernatural.
This is our first show, our first real show, in which we're pretending to be the podcasters that all of our tens of listeners expect us to be.
Exactly.
if you read a lot of stories and you listen to a lot of stories, you get the polished version. Robin is my editor, and she taught me how to tell stories, you know, one column at a time. And so what we wanted to do on this show was bring you into that process, not me presenting a packaged version of what Robin has helped me find, but into the process of Robin and I trying to find the story from the data and evidence and case that I want to make.
Good luck.
Good luck. Yeah. And for the record, this is how it goes with writers and editors is, you know, I'm pitching with like, you know, my whole heart on the line, and Robin just gets to be like the gladiator, like thumbs down, like this one wasn't good.
We maybe should clarify, I'm not your editor at Bloomberg.
You're not my editor at Bloomberg. You are no longer my editor.
That's right.
We are rekindling our writer-editor relationship.
Getting the band back together.
For the podcast.
For the podcast, right.
I'd just like to point out that from this perspective, this is like grossly unfair for Robin because I'm going in prepped, like guns blazing, like here's what I want to share with the world. And she just has to be sitting there cold, possibly rejecting me with all of you to hear. So this segment two is going to be...
It's raw.
It's raw. Segment two is raw. Segment one and three, we've thought about it. But segment two, this is just... Let's see if we make it to segment three. Okay. Here's what I want to talk about. And I have two things I'm trying to connect, and I'm missing something.
Okay.
One of Trump's first executive orders was, I'm not sure the technical term for this, the slashing of diversity, equity, and inclusion programming within the federal government.
Right.
And these workers were put on administrative leave. These offices were shuttered. Every DEI effort of the federal government came to a screeching halt within an afternoon. That follows movement at a lot of private companies to do the same, sometimes in response to activists who are trying to get them to do that. But this era of DEI is coming to a close. Mm-hmm. And I want to write some kind of elegy for it,
mm-hmm.
of what it was meant to do, what it didn't do.
Why it was so vulnerable to this attack.
Why it was so vulnerable. But I think what people miss when they... So DEI for me, maybe it's like autarky in this language of economics. It became a word that did not mean what I think it was trying to do. And so what I want... The story I want to tell is to explain in a way that people who might celebrate the end of DEI would understand that there is gross discrimination in our labor market.
Mm-hmm.
And DEI was not intended to elevate people. It was intended to find people that discrimination missed or that discrimination made you miss. And it was trying to correct for a problem and it didn't do it. I mean, mm-hmm. it didn't fix it. But the problem is still there. That's the issue, is that the problem is still there. So I have these threads of like, was DEI even a thing that we tried to do that hard? Was it all a PR campaign on behalf of mm-hmm. private companies? And the absolutely gross levels of discrimination and inequity that still live in the labor market. And then somehow tying that together to get people to feel like maybe not DEI, but we need to do something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So tell me some of the examples that you are looking at bringing in. Are you going to talk about any of the corporation moves?
I don't know, because corporate DEI, I mean, you have no idea what they were doing. I mean, a company was like, we have a very aggressive DEI campaign. Like, I don't know what that means. It's not like they turn over their data on hiring, firing, pay or promotion and say, why don't you guys all look at it and tell us how we did? I'm an economist. I want to see everything. I want all the pay scales.
I guess I was thinking about, I have been particularly interested in what happened with Target. Target made some very specific promises. They're based in Minnesota and coming straight out of the reaction to the murder of George Floyd, that they were going to do better very specifically about Black employees. And then they very publicly said, oh, never mind, about a month ago. You know, that to me was sort of the worst of both ends of it. It was so clearly a response not to the discrimination that you're talking about and the inequality in the labor market, but a political reaction. And of course, a political reaction is vulnerable to a shift in political sentiment.
But maybe that's the point I need to somehow make, is that it's the problem's still there. It's not like we're done.
No, and I think they even said, they weren't moving the needle.
Yes, it's this acknowledgement of, we don't need to do it anymore, not because it's solved, but because it's not our job.
Mm.
We tried one thing and it didn't work, so we're not going to try anymore.
Right.
That's DEI. So right. I think it would be fair for me to talk about what we mean by discrimination exists in the labor market, and that's a fact, not a speculation or opinion.
Yeah. Let's put out some of those data points.
I've written about this before, that there is this kind of pervasive belief that because of DEI, somehow white men are like falling in their status.
Right.
Absolutely and unequivocally not true. As long as we have had labor market data, Black people have been behind white people in unemployment rate, in earnings, in hiring. And when we test to see if this is because they are Black, the tests come back with almost no variation, even over a quarter of a century. Yes, it is because they are Black. Economists didn't pioneer this. We figured out a way to do it really quickly and come up with a lot of studies. So it's called audit testing, and it was something that the Department of Housing and Urban Development started in the 1970s, although back then it was called a slammed door test or a paired test. So what they would do is they would get two people, one Black, one white, and kind of coach them on various aspects of their finances, and then send them in turn to knock on doors when there was a for rent sign.
Right.
And what they were testing for was the slammed door, that Black people would get a door slammed in their face when they wanted to rent somewhere. And brace for impact, they found it.
Shocking.
Shocking. And they've done this over the years, where HUD has, you know, they've expanded their methods, but it's still very much the same flavor.
Is this the same thing that they do with those resume submission tests?
Yes. Audit studies are really common, and we use it to test all kinds of discrimination in the labor market. We use it to test if there's discrimination against unemployed people who have gaps on their resume, against people who went to certain colleges, if private school matters more than public school, and so on. And it's still, I mean, you still find massive gaps. It's a very effective tool at finding gaps in how people are treated in the labor market.
Mm-hmm.
So most people, when you read the news, you see the unemployment rate. We calculate the unemployment rate for every demographic group that's possible. And it might surprise some people, although it's so true to be a fact in labor economics, that the Black unemployment rate is almost always twice the white unemployment rate.
Mm-hmm.
So if the overall unemployment rate is 4%, the unemployment rate for white people is closer to 3%, and for Black people, it's closer to 6% all the time.
Yeah.
And what's particularly disturbing about that is that there could be a good reason for that, because, you know, white people and Black people don't have the same jobs, they don't have the same level of educational attainment, and so there could be kind of a difference in their various characteristics as workers that would explain the unemployment rate. But the problem is that the unemployment rate for white men with a high school degree who never went to college is about the unemployment rate for Black men who have a college degree.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't like a 1 month or it happened during a recession. This is just a permanent feature of inequality in our labor market, that Black men, you know, essentially the type of boost you would get to your labor market opportunities as seen through the unemployment rate, Black men don't get. And it aligns perfectly with these studies of resumes that find that a Black name will have you called back less.
Right, right. So I'm just thinking about how these things compound too.
I mean, this is the problem, right? That you have DEI as people see it, you know, Target says, we're going to try or hire Black people. And then they're like, we're not going to do this anymore. Versus this kind of immutable fact about the U.S. labor market that Black people and white people do not have the same level of success due to their race. There's some way to connect this here to kind of bring home that the end of DEI shouldn't be the end of trying.
Yeah. I think that the argument that, you know, merit and quote unquote competence is the end all be all, it's sort of winning the day. Except that what we know from those studies is that it's not winning the day. We've got people who are equally meritorious and equally competent who aren't being given opportunity.
The same opportunity. So the idea of DEI was always misunderstood, and that it's not trying to elevate people just for the sake of like hitting some numbers in terms of the, you know, a company's diversity.
And people absolutely believe that that's what DEI is.
Yes, I think most people would tell you it's just about finding Black people or gay people or women to work here so that when they publish their statistics on who works here, they can say we're diverse.
And I'm just going to tell you, by the way, as a gay person, nobody ever counts the gay people.
I'm sorry, I laughed.
It's true. They don't. And
public surveys don't count the gays. I will say, the census doesn't have, we don't have a straight gay wage gap because the census doesn't count the gays. If I'm allowed to say the gays.
You can see the gays.
Okay, great.
they do salary surveys, right? And gay men earn more than above average salaries often, and gay women don't. At least that used to be the case. And, you know, whatever. I'm not griping.
You can gripe a little bit.
You know, but, you know, absolutely. Gay people don't get all sorts of jobs because they're gay.
And DEI is not about elevating people above their station. It was a recognition, or maybe it wasn't a loud enough recognition, that people are missed. Mm-hmm. And it's correcting after the fact that people are missed. Mm-hmm. And that if you have systemic discrimination and bias built into a search mechanism, then you are going to disadvantage Black people who are just as capable of being there. So this elegy I want to write, it's somewhere between like, hey, just so we all remember, discrimination is definitely a thing. The labor market is not an equal or meritocratic place, not in the way that you think. I never really thought that much of DEI initiatives at private employers. I think some of them were very well-intentioned, but this is about productivity and your bottom line. Mm-hmm. You are missing out on the best talent. Mm-hmm. That is the story. For private companies, you are missing out on the best talent, and that is absolutely the story. And so you need to fix your talent pool to reflect that. But I don't know. Something about the elegy had to do with, like, white people. Mm-hmm. And what does it mean for white people if this problem was solved?
If this problem of discrimination in hiring were solved?
If this problem in discrimination against Black people in many labor market institutions, in education, hiring, promotion, and so on. Because I got a question about this through the DMs that was basically, I mean, they didn't say this because it was very hateful the way that they said it, but the... The basic question was, in a world where Black people are treated equally, are white people worse off? Mm. And can you speak to that? And I was like, wow,
loaded question. Yeah.
There was some kind of like, is this what's actually wrong with DEI? Is that no one's willing to admit that you want white people to be worse off? You can't see because we're recording audio. I can't see because it's a podcast that I'm just like
rubbing her face.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe I should say deep sigh. These are the pieces I have, right? I have discrimination is real and bad.
Yeah.
I have DEI didn't solve it and is gone. Mm-hmm. And the conversation of what comes next almost seems taboo. In today's climate to say, and we keep trying and like pursue the policy that will make a difference as opposed to doing the same thing over and over again and expecting Black people to suddenly magically become economically equal to white people. Mm-hmm. This puts the just unfettered attack on federal workers into deep perspective that, you know, of all the employers in the labor market, the federal government was probably the closest to equal between Black and white as you get.
Really?
Really, yes. The federal government is more diverse in the right ways than the private sector. So I had a paper about this that I did while I was at RAND that looked at Black-white pay gaps amongst highly educated STEM workers. And the question that was put to us was, how does the federal government change its compensation in order to recruit like the highest talent STEM people? And what we pointed back out to them, which they didn't really love, is that you don't want to pay like the private sector because the private sector has incredible inequality between Black and white STEM workers and between male and female STEM workers, and that it's one of the, like, in terms of just unexplained wage gaps that come down to discrimination, You do not want the federal government to pay like the private sector, because you'd be absorbing the private sector's inequality, whereas the federal government actually does a really good job of not absorbing racial discrimination that is palpable in its private sector competitors. As far as we are an equal opportunity employer, not many places put their money where their mouth was, but the federal government did.
Do you think that you can write this piece so that it's narrowed to the federal workforce?
Maybe there's a separate piece on what's at risk when you target the federal government as an employer, not as, you know, what did he call it? I'm not going to justify it or elevate it, but it's a baseless attack on our federal workforce, but it's also an attack on a really, really good employer.
Yeah.
So it's two things.
Yeah.
I feel like I could have seen this beforehand, that like the private sector needs to do one thing and the public sector needs to do one thing. It's like one of them needs to continue involving and the other one needs to defend.
I'm just also thinking about how much power we're giving larger and larger consolidated corporations, you know.
That's got to be a whole other episode about labor market concentration. And if you've got four big firms and one of them is deeply racist in hiring, like never going to progress.
Yeah.
Too many eggs in one basket.
But
okay, so I'm writing about DEI almost as like the performative DEI that the private sector had and walked away from.
Right.
That in some ways was separate from the actual progress that was made mm-hmm. in reducing black-white differentiation in certain places. I don't know. Do I have to put in there something like, so are white people worse off when black people are equal? Because there's a lot of people who would say yes.
Yeah. You know, it's sort of, again, that thinking about the economic pie, I think, and how, as a company, are you worse off if you've got a smaller talent pool to draw from? As a boss, are you worse off if you don't have a bigger talent pool to hire from? I mean, it's as if there's only a finite number of jobs, and if we give some to black people, white people won't get them. That's not how an economy works.
I mean, so some people would view the hiring process as a zero-sum game. Like, this company has 100 jobs, and so if they apportion 5 for black people, it should be closer to 15 because that's the share of their population. But if they say 15 jobs for black people, that means that 10 white people won't get it. And I think they view it as a zero-sum game with any – I think maybe this is this, like, secret third thing we write about, but because – there can be zero-sum games within an abundance economy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, there are a fixed number of spots of who goes to Harvard.
Right.
And it is possible that if they try harder to find bright black people who their typical systems of finding bright people for Harvard overlook, that there are going to be fewer white people that attend. And that is a zero-sum game within Harvard. But that doesn't mean white people don't get to go to college.
Right.
So there's some notion here of you can be right and wrong at the same time. Like, you can be right. There is a zero-sum game. I'm only hiring for one position.
Right.
But that's not the only job in the economy. Like, college admissions is not a zero-sum game. Employment is not a zero-sum game. The economy is not a zero-sum game, even if there's only a fixed number of spots at a particular place.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's some kind of, like, nuance there of, like, the zero-sum abundant world.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to be easy, but if you can address that question and answer it in that way, I think that's a useful contribution to the conversation around whether it was misguided or whether it was misunderstood.
Misguided versus misunderstood. There's something here too about how, I mean, do most white people see themselves as like the marginal admission to a job or school that like, I've always thought it was interesting that in these conversations, so many white people would identify as like, the marginal 1%. Like, I'm not going to get into Harvard if they let in black people at a higher rate.
Mm-hmm. I'm the person on the bubble.
I'm on the bubble. It speaks to something to overall economic insecurity that people have, that they kind of see themselves as on the bubble. Like, I'm on the bubble for everything. Yeah. Are we using on the bubble correctly? I think so.
I think we are.
Any sports metaphors really dangerous for me?
That's not a sports metaphor.
It's not?
I don't think so.
I thought they talk about it in the basketball tournament?
Well, maybe, but I think that the metaphor has to do with a level. Am I wrong?
Oh my God, my mind is blown. My mind is absolutely blown.
You're kind of actually making my brain hurt a little with this, because it it's almost a narcissism or like an exceptionalism. Like, well, I'm the one who's getting hurt out of these 99 other people who also applied for this job, right?
Like, maybe this is the story that like what you got wrong about DEI. The lesson you should have learned was just how on the bubble people feel.
Everyone feels
on the bubble about making it in our economy, to the point that if, like, hey, if one Black person gets a job, that's my job that's lost. Mm-hmm. And it's that was one thing that we didn't learn from DEI. And I think maybe the second thing we didn't learn from DEI was how to talk about who loses in a zero-sum game in an abundance world. Mm-hmm. And that there was no like two-way recognition on people who didn't like DEI and people who were in favor of it, of like, yeah, there is a zero-sum aspect. I don't give 500 people one job. But at the same time, it's not like those 499 people are condemned to never work again because there's only a fixed number of jobs in the economy. Mm-hmm. And so that you had these two big losses from the DEI conversation that we never had. And this is what, at least at its like demise, we can talk about these two aspects of the labor market.
I like that. I really do.
Okay. Thank God we're recording. What was the second thing I said? No, okay. We'll go back and listen. Sometimes it just comes off the dome and they're like, I like that. I'm like, What did I say? Okay. The two things we didn't learn. That's why I said the two things we didn't learn. Okay. This is good. This is what I'm going to write about. The two things we didn't learn from DEI. That we can discuss at its funeral. At the Irish wake for DEI. Mm-hmm. We're going to stay up all night talking, drinking, and singing.
And we're going to feel pretty hungover tomorrow.
Let's move on to the equally cleverly titled segment 3. We wanted to do something that was equivalent to the last page of a magazine, where it's always something really short and it's a little bit fluffy. So what we've decided is that we're going to give, this is a show that we talk a lot about, you know, policy and actions. We're going to give for you our policies in the dictatorships that we run that are very mercurial and petty, but it's how we would run the world.
How we would run the world. And we could call it that.
How we would run the world.
But I think we should call it executive order. I have a new appreciation for executive orders.
For executive orders.
Executive Order 1 in the Republic of Rousey is, I call the No Logos on My Life Act, though I guess it wouldn't be an act.
It wouldn't be an act. No Logos on My Life Law.
Law. E-O. Yeah, and it would be that, you know, you have a right to buy things with no logo on it. Apple. And cars, especially.
All cars.
My dad likes to say that you should always know what you want in case your car gets totaled. So I'm always looking at cars. And there are cars I will not buy because their badge is so ugly. Looking at you, Cadillac.
I'm just going to say it. This is a really Gen Xer take. some sellout logo car.
Can't stand it. Anyway, yeah, that would be my petty thing.
Okay, the executive order from the Edwards Republic is that I think President's Day is a dumb holiday. It's vague. It doesn't say which president. Apparently, it's actually spelled differently in a bunch of different states about whether or not it's like there's an apostrophe there. So shout out to Optimist Economy that we kind of have the same problem. So maybe I'm projecting. But President's Day is, I mean, if you told me that there was a country that has a day where you're supposed to honor its dead past leaders, I'd be like, 80% it's a fascist country. Like, that's just, we live in a democracy. We have the right to assail our leaders in however sarcastic way we want. I don't know why we have a day honoring them. We should come up with a new holiday. We could just have every federal holiday be birthdays to dead people. It would still be better than just random President's Day. We can't agree on Washington versus Lincoln, and we can't give people 11 days off. We're so cheap on federal holidays, we have to squish together two presidents whose birthdays happen to lie near each other. I disapprove. I 100% disapprove. You either give me two holidays or we come up with another one because presidents is not working. That is my executive order.
Love it.
Before we end our show today, we would, of course, like to thank our sponsors, which, as you know, are not financial but spiritual. The spiritual sponsor I'd like to thank for the week is Doechii's Grammy performance, which I have watched on YouTube upwards of 15 times.
The spiritual sponsor I'd like to thank is, thank you to Catherine for this recommendation, Chapel Roan and My Kink is Karma, which I like to blast at full volume in my car.
Yes. Finally, we'd like to thank our producer, Sophie, without which this show would not be possible. She doesn't just edit us and make us sound smart, but frankly, she makes us both a lot less nervous in an endeavor that we find very nerve-making. So, snapping out, Sophie. This is Optimist Economy. We are on all the platforms. We have a newsletter. I'm Ked's Economist. I'm on all the platforms and I have a newsletter. Robin is nowhere and doesn't want to be.